Okay, folks, we'll be getting going in just a minute. So if there's any new people with us tonight, welcome. We welcome guests at any time at the ROPC group meetings, be they Q&A sessions or regular monthly meetings. And if you want to become a member, I paste it into the chat window where you can go to join up, or if you just go to our webpage at opcug.ca, there's a link for join or renew, and it's only $20 a year. So if you want to join, that'd be great. Otherwise, we do welcome people to stay as guests as long as they want. I'm going to go ahead and mute all now. And as usual, people will be able to unmute themselves. Please feel free to do so if you have a comment or question, or use the chat window. Later on this evening, the contents of the chat window, the audio track, and the deck in PDF format will be going up on our website, courtesy of the work of Helen. And I think with that, we are now at the 7:30, so I will kick it over to Helen to lead us through tonight's deck.
Okay, thanks, Chris. Yeah, we have a number of topics tonight, as usual. I'm going to kick off with one which I'm calling, what the heck is HEIC? And I had a relative staying with us a few days ago, and when she went home, she sent a whole bunch of photographs, and they came up as this .heic file extension, and which didn't actually mean anything to me, so Mr. Google, of course, knows. It turns out this is a high-efficiency image container, and it's basically an Apple product, so for people who use iPhones and iPads and take pictures with Apple devices, mobile devices, they get these HEIC images, and the note below there shows you that it's actually very economical. They say for an equivalent level of resolution and so forth, the HEIC file takes about half that required for a JPEG. And so that's quite interesting. However, the next thing that happens is, of course, I try to open it. And on the machine I try to open it with, I get this pop-up, which tells me that I need an HEVC video extension in order to display the file, this being in Windows. But you notice I can download and install it now, so let's go and download and install it now. And that takes me off to the Windows Store, the Microsoft Store, and it turns out Microsoft want the huge sum of 99 cents to allow me to download this file this extension. Now, I'm not a big fan of Microsoft, and I really object to paying them more money. So I go back to Mr. Google and search for HEIC to JPEG converters, and there's a ton of online ones. But I checked even further, and eventually I found this site, super user site, and it tells me that OpenView, which a lot of people in the club here use as a video editor, as an image editor, OpenView will actually batch convert files, which is a really useful feature. You can do, 10, 100 files all at once. And notice there's no paywall and no other junk. It just works, just like Linux. And talking about Linux, the other thing you can do, or the other thing I can do, because I have GIMP, the GNOME image manipulation program, this is an image editor, which is a bit like Photoshop, but I think it's a bit easier maybe to use. It will actually open HEIC files. And once they're open, you can edit them, resize them, change the colors, do whatever. But notice on the left-hand side there, you can also save as a JPEG. So GIMP doesn't do batch conversion, but I only had a handful of files to work with. So basically, I just use GIMP and use this save as JPEG to do all the file conversions for me. And that worked out very well. So if anybody ever sends you Apple image format files, you don't have to pay Microsoft to to decode them. Is GIMP only on Linux? No, GIMP is multi-platform, so there is a version of GIMP available for Windows, for example.
And Mac OS as well.
It's free and it's open source and it works really well. And there's a ton of online how-to PDF files and video tutorials on YouTube. Anything you want to do, somebody's going to tell you how to do it. Okay, moving along, talking about photos, Chris has got something on generative erase.
Yeah, we've had a lot of things about AI-based things, a lot of it courtesy of Bob Harris, who's on the call tonight. And I came across this that Windows Photos, which is built into Windows 10 and 11, was getting this new feature called generative erase. Before that, they had another tool. I'll talk about it in a second. But they were rolling out this new feature, and it's going out to all Windows 10 and 11. One of my computers that had Windows 11 got this feature quite a while ago, and I was holding off because my main desktop PC hadn't gotten it, and I was a little bit curious about that. It finally got it, so I figured, okay, there's probably most people have it by now. So next. So previously they had another tool called SpotFix, and it was really, really kind of a weak tool. You could basically just click over top of something, and then it would basically blur everything that was underneath the cursor. You couldn't draw a stroke with it. You couldn't modify the size. I don't believe you could modify the size of the circle, and it basically just did a blur. So it was pretty poor tool. Next. And the promise of this new tool called Generative Erase, which is completely replacing the SpotFix, is that it's an AI-powered feature. Of course, everything has to be AI-powered nowadays. Allows you to remove unwanted objects from your photos and without disrupting the background behind them. So basically what it does is it looks at what is around that area, and it tries to guess at what would be underneath that object that you're trying to remove, and it will replace it with content that seems to fit in with the surrounding area. Next. So here's an example of it in operation. So say I have this old building, and I have this sign in front of it, and I want to remove that sign. Next. So you select the erase tool on the toolbar in Windows Photos. Next. And then there's an option to turn off auto reply. I suggest that you actually and I suggest that you do turn that off, and I'll talk about that in a second. Next. And then you can set the brush size to whatever you want. Next. And then you just paint over the area that you want to be erased. So I had a fairly small brush, and I just brushed over the area for the sign and the post. Next. And then, because I said I turned off that auto apply, it comes up with the dialog box where I can actually change my existing mask that I painted in. So I could add to that, or if I accidentally with my mouse went to too large an area, I could actually erase part of that mask that I created. If you didn't choose that or turn off the auto apply, when you brush with it, as soon as you release the mouse button, it will go ahead and do it. So I like doing that where it's turning off that automatic feature, and that way I can adjust what it is that's going to get removed before it actually gets applied. And when you're happy with the way that things are lined up, then you will just click on the erase button at the bottom. Next. And when you do it, it erases the sign, and you can see that it's filled in the background with material that is sort of believable of what might have been there in behind that sign. So it actually does quite a nice job. Next. So there are a lot of photo editing tools now that have a similar type of tool. So they'll call it things like generative fill or AI erase, or On One Photo Raw calls it perfect eraser, and so forth. So an awful lot of photo editing tools now are doing this. All of them can do a very good job. All of them can do a very poor job. When they decide that they're going to fill in that area with something else. Sometimes they just make wildly crazy decisions, and you can just either undo it and redo it, and it might do something different the next time, or you could use some other editing tools to refine what it is actually done. Next. Now, there is the original that was done with, on the left, is the one that was done in the brand new generative erase feature in Windows Photos. The right-hand one, or the one in the middle of the screen, this was done by Microsoft Photos in the middle one is the one that was erased using the generative erase in the brand new tool. Next. This is what was done by Microsoft Digital Image Smart Erase in 2006. Now, they did not call it generative erase. They did not call it AI tool or anything like that. They just called it Smart Erase, and it did exactly the same idea. It just tried to fill in the area with stuff that was similar to what was around the thing that you were erasing. So this is absolutely nothing new in terms of it being a tool, and I seriously question how much AI is actually behind this. Next.
You're there.
Oh, that's it. Yeah. So if you haven't got it yet in Microsoft Photos, then it probably will come to you soon in one of the monthly updates. But in all likelihood, you do have that tool available. And so for free, in the box, in Windows, you can do this erasure of objects and replacement of the background with similar material to what's around it.
Sure, the mortar is better defined in the AI version.
I have had really bad results as well. This is one of the best results that I got. I don't know, you know, what is the magic thing that makes it good or bad, but it differs wildly from one photo to the next and what you're trying to remove.
You should have compared that with your Pixel Magic Erase.
Yeah, I don't use I don't use photography on my Pixel at all. It's probably quite similar in that it can do a really good job and it can do a really horrible job.
You are probably using tiny screens, Chris?
Yeah, just what I want to do, edit all my photos on a 6-inch screen.
Yeah, imagine trying to edit a photograph on a phone. It's pretty difficult.
Not
this level of detail, anyway.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks very much, Chris. Okay, last week I mentioned that we're looking for ideas for topics for Q&A, and I said that one of the things we do is computer basics, but Chris and I have a problem. We've covered all the computer basic things more or less that we can think of, and we have a problem knowing what people want to know. So I said, well, you can fill out your wish list here, the top three things that you'd like to know on basic computer technology, and nobody sent anything in. So I don't have any computer basics tonight, but we also do smartphone basics. So if you want to edit the form and make it into smartphone basics, we can do one or the other. And at the Pizza Q, there was some discussion about smartphones. And one of the comments was that the individual didn't know really how to manage the icons on the display screen. So I thought I'd spend a few minutes talking about a few things that I do to arrange my screens on my smartphone. Clearly, the first thing you can do is you can just tap on an icon on the display screen and it will open an app. And I think everybody must know how to do that one, otherwise you'd never be able to do anything with your phone. And it's essentially like left-clicking the mouse on an icon on a Windows computer, except by default in Windows, you have to double-click on the icon to open the application. In Android, the default is just to tap once on the icon. The second thing you can do is to drag the icons around on different areas of the screen, and in fact on different screens altogether. And to do that, you touch and hold the icon and then drag it anywhere in any direction you want. And typically you drag it to an open space and then let go, which is like drag and drop on the Windows, where you left click the mouse, hold it down, and then drag the icon or the window across the screen to a different location. And then the next third one I have is touch and hold, which you'll see sometimes denoted as a long press. So you press on the icon and basically hold it down. And when you do that, you'll get a context menu popping up. So this is like right-clicking on an icon on a Windows computer, where you get a context menu with a whole bunch of options that you can apply to that particular item. So in this case, long press is generally you're removing an icon from the screen. You might be uninstalling an app if that option is available. Or the system apps, you can actually disable them, which saves this space essentially. So here's a Samsung phone, and the Saturn icon here is a Samsung browser. So I can touch this icon and then drag it to the right. As I drag it to the right, I will see that there is an open space here where I can leave it. I drag it into this open space and take my finger off the icon, and I've moved the browser icon a couple of spots over to the right-hand side. Okay, so long pressing. So here's the Saturn icon in its new location. Now I'm holding the icon down, and I'm getting this pop-up box right here, and here's the exploded view. And you can do a bunch of things, but typically what you want to do is remove this icon from the display screen. Now this is a system application. It's a Samsung system application, and they won't let me uninstall it, and they won't let me disable it. They'll only let me remove it, which all that does is just deletes it from the display screen. It doesn't uninstall the app. It still stays in the box of applications if you want to reinstate it later on. And on the Samsung phone, you basically swipe up from the bottom of the screen, and it will open up the screens that have all the applications that you can choose from. Now here's another app. This guy is K9, which is an email client. This is the equivalent of Thunderbird for Android. There is no Android version of Thunderbird, so I use K9. And you notice when I long press K9, I get a different context menu. I can still remove the icon from the screen, but now notice now I also have the option to uninstall it. So I can uninstall this email client from my phone, because this is a user installed application from the Google Play Store. And because I installed it, I am allowed to uninstall it. It's not a system application. So depending on what kind of app you have, you get various options. And here's a third one. This is Google Maps. So in this case, I can remove it from the screen, and I can't uninstall it. It's a Google system app, but I can disable it. As I said earlier, if you want to save space, this space, if you have a bunch of apps that you don't use, you can just uninstall them if they're user-installed apps. And that gets rid of all the storage space. But if it's a system app, you're not allowed to uninstall it. What you can do is you can disable it. And when you disable it, it takes it back to a factory level of installation, which is kind of very low level, uses a lot less space, and it doesn't update automatically. So you also save time, because now you're not updating apps that you actually don't use. So those are the kind of things you can do with a long press. Now, the other kind of icon that I see on my phone is this guy on the top left here, which is a folder. So if I touch on that icon, which is there are multiple apps inside this folder, you can see it pops up this screen here, where I've got the name of the folder, which is Google, And there's a whole bunch of Google apps inside, and I can launch these, I can drag them around, whatever. So I have a way of having multiple applications only taking up one icon on the display screen. And then another thing you can do is with just about any icon, just about any application, is you can do the long press, and you often will get a add to the home page. So it will actually put maps onto the home page of my phone. And actually what it does is, it, if I've got multiple pages, you might have a home page and then page two and page three, it actually will put it on page three because that's the last page. So in this case, it will drop it. Well, I've actually done this with an email application. This is a Samsung email application, which I brought out from my box of tricks. And I've dropped it. I've done the add to home page. And you notice here that I'm on the third page of three pages of my home page. But now let's say I want to move that. So I can do that touch and drag thing. I can touch and drag it, and I can drag it across page, from page three, across page two, and onto page one, onto my real home page, if you like. So here we are, we just touch, drag, and then when we find the empty space over here, we let go, and then it's moved it from this page three, that's now blank, and the icon we wanted on the home page is now on page one of the home page. So this drag and drop thing is actually very flexible, and it allows you to arrange the icons, group the icons into logical sequences, and only have the icons available on screens where you actually want them. So it's a very useful technique. Now, as well as having things like Google folders, you can create your own folder. So for example, let's say I have two icons. Here's my Samsung email app. Here's Google Maps. If I touch Google Maps and drag and drop him on top of email, that will actually create a folder. And when I do that, you can see that both of these icons now drop into the folder. And now I have a folder name, which is editable. So I can go into that, and I can change that to anything you want. And I've chosen to put my apps, for example. So, and those are the things that I do normally. I don't use folders typically, but they are on my phone, so I thought I'd mention those. And now the question is, does anybody else have any other tips and tricks for managing smartphone icons? Because I don't know anymore. So was there anything in the chat, Chris?
The only addition, I guess, at this point is Tom mentions that if you install Firefox, you can disable Chrome as your browser. I presume you could actually disable, well, I don't know if you can disable Chrome if you don't install an alternate browser. But, yeah, if you don't like Chrome, you could do that. And that's it.
Okay.
For what it's worth, Alan, I have all my apps, and I suppose I have more than most, but I have them all in different folders on my home screen so that, and in folders you can put up to, I don't know, 9 or 10 apps before it actually, then you get pages within the folders. But you can have about 9 apps, that just show there. So then, on your home page, you can have, 9 or 10 or 12 folders. And inside of those, you can have another 9 apps. So you can reach any of your, 100 apps inside of 2 button pushes. So that's a lot. I find that much faster than having, multiple home pages.
Yeah. Personally, I use very few apps. So all the apps I use are on my home page, and the ones I don't use very often are on page 2. And so I really don't, personally, I don't have any need for folders. But I can see if you've got, dozens of apps, and that's a pretty efficient way to deal with them, sure. Okay, somebody's asking, Elizabeth's asking about, well, not asking, she wants to try this on her iPhone. I don't know whether you can do folders. I'm sure you can do folders on iPhone, but I don't know whether you use the same technique. If anybody knows, you can put something in the chat for us, or we'll come back to it later on. Okay,
Karen,
next up.
Before we move on, Karen mentions that she uses the Microsoft Launcher for more personalization options. And I think there are some other launcher apps as well, which basically replaces your home screen with another user interface. And I think there are a couple of other ones, but yeah, I've heard of the Microsoft Launcher before, and that's always an option as well.
Okay, all right, thanks, Chris. Actually, Chris, you're up next with a share. Another share on AI.
Yeah, AI on the brain this week, I guess. Bruce Schneier, he's a security guru, very smart guy. He's a cryptographer. He actually submitted code when they were looking for replacing what eventually became AES. I think he was with a group of other cryptographers with a competing standard that they had come up with. So a very smart guy, and he is well regarded in the security realm of things, physical security as well as IT security. He does have a monthly newsletter called Cryptogram, and I highly recommend it if you're interested in security at all. You can get it sent to you by email. You can just go and read it on his website, and I've got the URL there. I'll paste it into the chat as well in a minute. So next, this latest issue of Cryptogram, I saw two interesting articles that he had that were dealing with artificial intelligence, and one was how it will change democracy. And so that was quite interesting about when you're actually talking about electoral type things and, you know, how AI is going to actually change things there. And it's not all for the worst. It's there's some things that are definitely going
to seems to be working.
Definitely.
I'll go back to
I'm going to mute. Yeah, very interesting, and there was a lot of information there that it's not all doom and gloom. There's some really, really good things that are going to come out for democracy using AI, so I highly recommend that one. And then there was another interesting article on the idea that AI is going to increase both the quality and the quantity of phishing scams, and that's not so good. And so I don't know that there's anything in there that will be a positive. But one interesting part of that article was they actually went and asked AI to assess scam emails to say whether these were scams or not. And interestingly, most of the AIs did a very poor job at assessing whether something was a scam or not. But both those articles, I found them quite interesting. You might want to read them if you have any interest in AI or security in general. That's it for me.
Okay, thanks, Chris. And Bob Harris has said that iPhones folders work very well, and they're easy to name and rename. So if you have an iPhone or an iPad, you can clearly use folders very readily. And something else just came in.
That was me.
Oh, that's Chris.
Also, there's a guy by the name of, I guess, Rob Vaxman or something like that. I just sent a link in the chat, but he figures that this AI on your phone with these neural processing units that started with the Pixel 6 and with the iPhone 15 or 16, I don't know, that this will allow, or it is planned for the three-letter agencies in the United States, the NSA, CIA, and et cetera. CTC, a three-letter agency? Anyway, he figures that this will allow the three-letter agencies to spy on you if presumably they think you're a bad guy. I have my doubts about it, but it might be interesting to watch the particular show. He has a whole series of YouTube videos on privacy, and it's worth, I think a lot of them are very worthwhile.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Tom. Okay, so blue screens of death. This is the typical blue screen that you can get with Windows. Less so these days, I think, on Windows 10 than I used to see on earlier versions of Windows. But the question I put here is, why should Windows users have all the fun? And the reason for that is because in today's PC world, there was this article from somebody in Germany, in a translation, that Linux is going to get its own kind of blue screen of death. So if the Linux system sees in what's known as a kernel panic, then it will generate some kind of blue screen, which will tell the user that Linux is dead and you have to reboot. No, that doesn't happen very often, but I have actually seen it, so it can happen, and it is recoverable, so that's okay. So you're not on your own. We Linux users are suffering occasionally too. But the interesting thing is, I talked about this guy, Dave Plummer, a Microsoft engineer, retired, who has this YouTube channel. And one of his postings is, why are blue screens blue? And it's really interesting. And he talks about why the Windows kernel can have issues that require it to shut down and basically give you a so-called blue screen of death. And in Microsoft parlance, this was called a bug check, and because there was a problem. And it was just telling the developers that there was a bug in the code which they had to go fix. But he also went to talk to the guy that developed the blue screen to find out, why is it blue? So if you have any interest in that stuff at all, I highly recommend this. It's only 15 or 16 minutes or so. And he's quite entertaining, this guy. And it's really quite an interesting episode. And he's got tons of other videos on Windows issues. Just check his main YouTube channel. And one of the things I saw recently too from him, which actually came up when I was just browsing YouTube on my phone, and looking at the YouTube shorts, he has this one called Learn C, which is a C programming language. Learn C in 60 seconds. So he kind of talks about programming languages and C and gives a couple of examples, all in less than a minute. So it's really quite interesting. So there's the URL for that too. Okay, next up we have what? Oh, okay, next we have talking about AI and scams. B sent this one in, which is a Bitcoin scam. And it's an invoice I guess it's kind of a receipt, really. It tells you that you just bought $374 and change worth of bitcoins. And you say to yourself, wait a minute, I didn't buy bitcoins. What's going on? So what you need to do is phone this 800 number, this 802 number, and I'm sure they're going to ask you for your PayPal credentials so they can check out your invoice. And of course, clearly this is actually a phishing scam, and I'm sure that's exactly what they're trying to do. They're trying to get your user ID and password so that they can go and clean out your PayPal account and your bank account that's behind it. So the usual fraud watch caution in place here. If it looks stupid, if it looks out unusual, if it's unbelievable, then don't believe it. It's clearly a scam.
And just to add insult to injury, 802 is not a toll-free number. So you'll be charged long distance to end up calling these people who are going to scam you.
Is it long distance or is it one of these premium numbers where they charge you?
Oh, it could. It could well be that. I just know that it is not toll-free. 802 area code phone numbers for business, $30 a month.
Some premium phone numbers, especially I think for some Caribbean countries, charge like $10 or $25 a minute. So Beware of the area code.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you notice that this
Hal, and we're having problems with your audio breaking up.
Do not react to this. What do you want you to call them? Flash up on the screen there. Chris, is it your item?
This was.
Have you lost me?
We had you breaking up and so forth. You seem to be fine now. So, okay. So onward and upward. So Windows 10 end of life, just a bit of a reminder, I guess, for people that October 14th, 2025 is currently end of life. And this came about because people started getting various pop-ups about whether they should or can't upgrade to Windows 11 on their Windows 10 machine. And so here's an example of one of these that you might get that says that your PC is not eligible to upgrade to Windows 11. And of course, they will just advise you to go buy a new PC in the end of it all. Next. And there we go. So here's an option where you are eligible for the free upgrade to Windows 11. So presumably they saw that your CPU was up to snuff. It had a TPM and all of the other hardware requirements for going on to Windows 11. And you are eligible for the upgrade, but they do give you the option down at the bottom, keep Windows 10. Of course, they will keep nagging you to take advantage of this free Windows 11 upgrade. There is no button on there say keep Windows 10 and don't bug me again. Unfortunately, they don't include that. So next. Now the question really comes down to really should you or do you have to or what are your options when it comes to a person sitting on a Windows 10 machine? If you are eligible for the upgrade, you can upgrade right as soon as they say. I have not heard of anybody who had problems with that upgrade. It's been around for a long time, so it's tried and true, we'll say. If you do the update, everything on your computer, all your programs will remain as they were. Your settings will remain the same. Your data will be the same. Your accounts on the computer will remain the same. So basically, you will just end up with Windows 11, and everything else should continue to work as it worked before. You can postpone the update to any time. Presumably, you would aim for doing the upgrade before October 14, 2025, when the last official update, security update for Windows 10 is going to be released. If you are not eligible for the upgrade, well, what do you do then? So you could do nothing until the deadline date and just keep going on and see what really comes about. I personally think that there's going to be two possibilities of what will happen. Either Microsoft will extend the end of life for Windows 10 much further. There are going to still be hundreds of millions of computers out there running Windows 10 come October 14th, 2025. I don't think Microsoft can actually cut those people off and say, you know, okay, you have to buy a new PC or you're going to be running without security updates. That would be unconscionable for them to do, and although they do unconscionable things, I don't think this is really an arbitrary sort of thing. They would get so much flack because there would be hundreds of millions of computers that are not going to be upgraded. The people will continue to use them, and when security flaws are found, which they inevitably will be, they will not get fixed. Or if they don't do that, the other option for them is that they could actually lower the requirements for an 8th gen Core i processor, which is what is currently required as a minimum for Windows 11, or the TPM requirements, which are all rather arbitrary, and I don't think they don't really stand the sniff test as being actually required. So they could relax the requirements and then allow these people that are on Windows 10 that currently can't upgrade to Windows 11 to allow them to upgrade to Windows 11. So I think one or the other of those is probably going to happen. However,
Chris, when you talk about extending the lifetime for Windows 10, you think that's going to be a free extension, or are they going to charge like they say they're going to do for commercial customers?
Yeah, I think it'll be free. And the reason being that, sure, they would love to charge for if you want to keep on Windows 10, it'll cost you a certain amount of money. There are going to be hundreds of millions of people who would not pay that. And the whole thing is Microsoft cannot afford to have a whole bunch of their customers, hundreds of millions of them, that are out there and refuse to pay anything, are sitting ducks, and you get some computers that get compromised, and they've got egg on their face. It's an arbitrary deadline. And much as they want people to move on to a more secure operating system, and I don't doubt one little bit that Windows 11 is a more secure operating system, they just can't afford to have it that there's all these people out there that are not getting security updates. So I think that's the most likely, is that they will just extend the deadline. And what they will hope is that they'll get to the point where people will have bought a new PC anyways, and they will come with Windows 11 or whatever is current Windows at that time. So they're just hoping for a certain period of time where there's virtually no computers left running Windows 10, and then they will end of life it. That's what I really think will happen.
I think there may be an exterior TPM that you could possibly add to your system using USB or maybe a plug-in to a system bus.
I don't see that as being a viable option either, because there are going to be lots of people who either technically don't feel adept to do it or just refuse to, and they say, no, I'm not going to toe the line on that. And it's an unreasonable expectation to place on your customers. And I think there will be enough people that will just say no. And I just don't think it'll happen. And that doesn't get around your other requirements for things like, minimum 8th generation, as a Core i processor. I forget what it is on the Ryzen, probably Ryzen 5 or something like that. But, it doesn't get around the other hardware requirements that are currently there that, again, I think are rather arbitrary requirements.
So Microsoft wouldn't want their customers leaving Windows and going off to Linux and maybe never returning?
Yeah, I don't think that Microsoft is actually afraid of that. I remember back in the days of when I was working in IT at Natural Resources Canada, and the government of Canada at the time was deciding that, well, we don't want to pay so much for things like Microsoft Office and Microsoft Windows and so forth. So they came up with this big grand plan that some foreign governments actually did this. Germany did it at one point, where they said, okay, we're going open source. And they went Linux and LibreOffice or whatever. And they actually did abandon Microsoft. And Government of Canada thought, oh, that's a great idea. Let's do that. And they went to Microsoft and they said, well, either you lower your price by such and such, or we are going to just go to Linux and LibreOffice. And Microsoft said, okay, go ahead. Because they knew that, the government of Canada was not in a position to actually follow through with that. So I don't think Microsoft is actually afraid of losing, a substantial part of their base to Linux. They're probably more afraid of losing people to Mac OS than they are to Linux, quite frankly.
The government of Ontario has switched to metric paper years ago, where you have A3, A4, A5, and they're all the golden ratio, and they all fit together, and you can cut, and that's really great, and that's what they use in Europe and Britain. And they tried it, and then I think they gave up after a few years because the rest of the Ontario stuck to 8.5 by 11.
Yeah, I mean that's the case with everything, including Windows and Microsoft Office. It's just it has become a de facto standard, and it's really, really hard to buck that. But it's not impossible, and certainly on an individual basis, that is, as the slide here has, that's one of the options. If you are an older machine, it can't be upgraded to Windows 11, and Microsoft sticks to the guns on an end of life that you want to continue using that PC, well, that is an option for you, switch to Linux. So there's people like Alan who's happy to help out people, and give them advice and help on moving over to Linux. I'm not saying it's necessarily, real easy to do, but it is an option. Another option is, yes, you just purchase a new computer. Now, the longer that the end of life gets pushed out, the more likely it is you're going to have a Windows 10 computer that you just decide, well, it's time for a computer upgrade. And whatever you buy, new to replace your aging computer, will actually be running current version of Windows, so you don't have that particular problem. You could also continue to use Windows 10 with no security patches. It's on the list here for completeness, not for advice. I certainly do not advise anybody to use an operating system or application programs that are not supported by the vendor from a security point of view. I don't care about feature updates. Windows 10, there are feature updates that are still coming into Windows 10, but I don't particularly care if I get any of those on my last remaining Windows 10 computer. But I do care about security updates, and I will not personally run an operating system without support from the vendor from a security point of view. But it is an option. Some people I know are still running Windows 7. And that's their choice if they decide to. I don't think it's a wise choice, but, yeah, it's a choice out there for it. So, there are options for people to think about as we get together, as we plow on towards October 14th, 2025. If you are running Windows 10, I highly recommend that you think about it. Think about what you're going to do if and when that end-of-life date comes and you're still running Windows 10. What do you want to do? Live with the risk? Dump the computer? Buy something new? Switch to Linux? Think about it before that deadline comes.
The other option there, Chris, which I don't think you talked about, was actually installing Windows 11 on a computer that is, in theory, non-compatible. Right now you can do that, you can force the upgrade, but whether Microsoft will stop that somehow in future, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know why they even left that as a viable option. I think maybe they just decided that it was easier to let people do it in that very few would actually follow through and do it, and it would shut those people up. If they shut down that capability to do it, then those people would get very vocal about, Microsoft is doing terrible things to us again. If it was left in place that people could circumvent the hardware requirements, then it would keep those people quiet, I think, is what's sort of behind that. Will they, they certainly have the capability to disable that so that, there are no workarounds, that if it's not hardware compatible, then you just can't run Windows 11. They could do that. I don't know what their thoughts are on that or their intentions or just how much they care. I don't know. It's an interesting question.
Yeah. I mentioned the last option there in terms of switching to Linux. And that's basically my plan. I don't have a computer right now that will support Windows 11. And all my computers are working. I hate throwing stuff away. I've been using Linux for so long. Right now, most of the time I'm using Linux, and I only use Windows for some fairly specific things. And most of those I could actually run on the Linux. And I think I only have one program, which is a proprietary program that won't run in Linux. It's only available for Windows. It doesn't run on the Wine, which is a kind of an emulator, Windows emulator. On Linux, it won't do that. So if I want to run that program, I have to run real Windows. And so my plan is, in the long term, I will generally use Linux for almost everything, including most including all internet access, because that's where the bad stuff is going to come from, probably. So Linux will close all that stuff down. If I need to update this program, I can download it on my Linux box and then just copy the file over and install it on Windows, which I think will be okay because it's a reputable organization and it's so obscure that nobody is going to hack this program because there's only a handful of dozens of users probably across North America, and it's not in the tens of thousands, for example. So I think that option for me, most of the time I'm going to be using Linux and occasionally I'll boot into Windows, and I think that's going to work fine for me, so I don't have a problem with it.
Yeah.
And personally, I think Linux is really easy to use. It's got that bad reputation of being only for geeks from a long time ago when it was finicky and it needed a lot of command lines. But these days, it's just like Windows. You have one installation medium, a USB drive, let's say. You install Linux. It comes with all these applications which are built in. So LibreOffice, for example, is part of the distro, so you don't have to worry about that. There's a browser in there, email clients, media players, everything's, all the basic stuff is in the distro. 20 minutes to install it and you're up and running. And after that, it's just like Windows. It's got a desktop, it's got a taskbar, it's got icons, and I don't see the difference. It's just some of the things are different. You're not using File Explorer, you're using Nemo or some other file manager. But the operations are all the same. So once you get over the kind of initial learning curve, it's really easy to use. And the nice thing is you've got basically almost a year and a quarter anyway before the end of life comes. So you've got time to play with Linux and see if you can get along with it.
Gotcha.
So that's my advice is, If you're really not planning on going to Windows 11, start looking at Linux right now as an alternative. If you don't want to buy Apple hardware at incredible expense.
Yeah. And I've often said that you don't run an operating system to run an operating system. You run an operating system to run the programs that run under the operating system. And that is probably the one thing that for me is a showstopper for going to Linux, and that my main photo editor, it runs under either Mac OS or Windows, and that's it. And that I could probably find replacements for everything else that I use. Now, I'm not anxious to jump to Linux anyway, so, why bother jumping to it if I don't have to? But quite frankly, that to me is a showstopper, is the one program that, I don't want to do without. And so for me, I'll just stick with Windows and live with Microsoft being a bully and things like that. But if you can make the jump, I mean, in the chat, Karen, she wants to book her Linux conversion appointment with you, Alan. So if you want to set it up with her to do that,
scroll team viewer, Karen.
Trudy mentions that she saw a note about a light version of Windows 11 to be released this year. There was somebody who put out a bastardized version of, and they started, I think, with Windows 10, and I thought they already had a Windows 11 version out, and it was a stripped-down version that would run on more modest hardware and things like that. If it's not actually produced by Microsoft, packaged by Microsoft, I would avoid it. Quite frankly, a lot of people do it, and they're happy with it, but you never know if somebody else is packaging this, are you going to be running into problems? And something that certainly Microsoft is not going to fix for you. So I'd be very, very wary of any version of Windows that is not officially run by Microsoft.
Most computers made in the last 10 years can run virtual machines pretty well at the hardware level. So you could, for example, create virtual machines for anything that runs under different versions of Windows. I mean, you could have Windows 11, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, all the way down to Windows well, 3.1. Since Windows, nobody wants Windows 1. Then you could run those things. And if you cut off your virtual machine from any connection to the outside world, if you don't need any internet access for the program, such as your photo editor, then that would be a way to continue running Windows forever, whether it's 10, 11, I guess even future ones, whether at the same time as Linux.
But to me, what's the compelling reason why I should do that? There's no benefit to me going to Linux. I have my two main computers now, a laptop and a desktop. They are running Windows 11. I have one laptop still that is running Windows 10 that is on a 7th gen Core processor, so it's not eligible to be upgraded. But I don't really care about that one. That one is an older laptop that basically is an emergency laptop for me, is all it is. So there's no compelling reason for me to actually switch to Linux other than just sticking in poking the stick in the eye of Microsoft. But that gets old real quick. I'm comfortable with what I have now, and I don't see a compelling reason to switch to Linux. Now, if I had, older computers and I was, just hell and high water, I'm not going to get rid of a computer that is in perfect working order, fine. That might be enough of a tipping point for me, but I don't have that tipping point. My two main computers right now are modern enough that they are running Windows 11, and that's fine. And they will run my photo editing software and so forth. So I just don't see a compelling reason to switch away from Windows for me.
The other problem, Tom, is that, you can have your virtual machines cut off from the internet, but everybody needs to go to the internet. So you need at least one operating system that will get you onto the web.
Yeah, I think what Tom is saying, though, that you could be running Linux, and then in a virtual machine, I could run, a version of Windows. Probably I would be stuck to Windows 10, but I could run my photo editor there, and it would be cut off. So my internet access would only be from the Linux base machine, and that's a viable option. It's just that I don't see a compelling reason why I should bother doing that.
Okay. I said the next slide was going to be the last 10, but it's now the last 5. So amazing. I thought we were going to run out of information real quick, but lots of discussion on that last topic.
Yeah.
And Elizabeth had asked what operating system China was using, and Bob Harris says it's OpenKylin, which is a Linux-based system and developed by a community of around 4,000 Chinese developers. So remember, Linux is open source, so I'll bet any money they've taken the source code for Linux and converted it to create this Kylin distro, essentially. Okay, does anybody have any other burning issues or questions, comments, shares, things that everybody should know about?
For what it's worth, I put a list of the Firefox extensions that I use in the forum. So if anybody has any questions, just reply in the forum.
Okay, thanks for that, Tom. Okay, so while everybody's thinking, let me just remind everybody that after the pizza queue, we don't have any monthly meetings in July and August, so there won't be any monthly meetings until September. And the schedule, the lineup right now is in September we've got some guy is going to be talking about building a website. In October, Carol Pearson has volunteered to talk about Ottawa's public library services. And in November, Chris has arranged for a guy to talk about artificial intelligence. And that is as far as the board of directors have got in terms of a lineup of speakers for monthly meetings. So the question is, what does everybody want to see in December and ongoing into the new year? If you have any ideas for topics, and especially if you have any ideas for speakers, And more especially if you want to volunteer or to give a presentation at one of our monthly meetings, we would, as usual, love to hear from you. And of course, that spills out into ideas for topics for question and answer sessions and shares, like some of the ones you've seen tonight. And also, Bridget is always looking for articles for the newsletter. So any of the above, if you have any ideas or you want to volunteer to provide information, there's our email address, and we can direct your input to the appropriate agency. Okay, our next Q&A session will be next Wednesday, which will be June the 26th. And I will try and remember to send out the meeting notice a bit earlier than I did tonight. I got tied up with something else, and it was 7 o'clock before I remembered I had to send out the reminder. And maybe that's why we only have half the number of people we normally have. Anyway, sorry about that, people. I'll try better next time. So I think that's everything we have. I don't see anything else in the in the chat. So I think we're good until next week. So I hope everybody enjoyed the things that we did have tonight. Good discussion on various things. And we'll see you next Wednesday.
And don't forget that we don't have our regular monthly meetings in July and August, but the intention is that Q&A will continue throughout the summer.
As long as all those topics come pouring into the suggestion box.
That's right, yes. Yeah, if we run out of material, Q&A will be real short. Thanks, folks. We'll see you next week.